in its roughly 200,000 years of existence, problems of literally survival. We've already answered these questions for a huge number of species. We've killed them off.
Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author, Institute Professor Emeritus at MIT. He taught there for over half a century. His latest book, Who Rules the World? If you want to watch part one of our conversation, it was all of Monday's show, go to democracynow.org. I'll be speaking today in Chicago at 6:30 with Jeremy Scahill at the Chicago Temple Building on West Washington Street. Then on Wednesday in Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater. To Toronto, Canada, Thursday and Friday. Then on to Saturday in Troy, New York at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. On Sunday in New York and on Monday at the Philadelphia Free Library. You can check our website at democracynow.org as we continue our 100-city tour. Oh, Democracy Now! Is hiring for our Video News Production Fellowship and our internship program. Get more information at our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dennis Moynihan, Nirmeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dina, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today, we'll talk about the rise of Donald Trump.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, As Time Goes By in Shanghai, showing Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. As Time Goes By in Shanghai tells the story of Shanghai's Peace Old Jazz Band, performing together since 1980. Aged between 65 and 87 years, many of them have been playing jazz since the 1940s and have seen the world transform. From the Japanese occupation and the Cultural Revolution to capitalism on overdrive, the band members have seen the many faces of China and withstood government's suspicion of jazz. Again, that's As Time Goes By in Shanghai, Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group, presenting An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies. Two evenings with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, September 19th and 20th at the Keller Auditorium. Tickets for Neil deGrasse Tyson this September are on sale now, and more information is available at portland5.com.
I am officially for President of the United States. I'm really rich. I'm really rich.
Ska sitta och höra på sånt surreprat som detta här. Det gör jag inte.
Nobody would be tougher on ISIS than Donald Trump. Nobody would be tougher on ISIS than Donald Trump.
Uxura, it's your body.
Hvorfor fullfører du ikke løpet?
Hvorfor skal jeg det?
du veldig smart.
Hvorfor skal jeg det? Hvorfor skal jeg det? Hvorfor skal jeg det? Hvorfor?
Det gjør jeg.
Hvorfor skal jeg det? Hvorfor skal jeg det? Hvorfor skal jeg det?
Det gjør jeg ikke.
ISIS than Donald Trump. Nobody would be tougher on ISIS than Donald Trump.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals.
Only Rosie Several. O'Donnell.
Yaksura, it's your body.
Hvorfor skal jeg det?
Nå var du veldig smart.
I am officially running for president of the United States.
Dere viser det faen ikke på TV.
Okay. It's election day. If you haven't turned your ballot in, you should. And now you have to go down to Morrison Street and hand it in there. That's what you have to do in order to vote today. And it's really worth the trouble. There's a lot of interesting candidates and some issue stuff. And I don't know how to persuade people to vote if they haven't. But I'm just saying, get your ballots in. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and me, Joe Uris. We want to hear from you, 231-8187. And we're gonna talk about, and this is my position, not necessarily anybody else's, why Trump is likely to be not only the Republican standard bearer, which is obvious, but very likely to be the next president of the United States. And it's weird, it's creepy, but it may be real. So, Abe.
Yeah.
What you think? I am after yesterday's paper with a Paul Krugman piece, talking essentially about his ability to muster the support of people who are fundamentally ahistorical. The fact of the matter is that a large number, we see it often, large number of white people, mostly working class, but not necessarily, also middle class, not necessarily uneducated, by the way, seem to be rallying to Trump, seem to dislike Hillary Clinton, seem to support, some of them support Bernie Sanders, and then say that they would not support Hillary if Bernie leaves the race, and Bernie has to leave the race because of the numbers involved. And then there's this concept, the promise to make America great. And this is really the key to a lot of feeling in America. It's really important to understand that the improvements in the lives of working class people in America and eventually the middle classes took place not in the lifetimes of most of our audience, but previous to that. We have, during the Great Depression, the incredibly progressive government of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I really want to point out that what Bernie Sanders is a New Deal Democrat. He's not a radical socialist or something like that. He's a New Deal Democrat, and he's urging a continuation of the traditions of FDR and of Truman, in fact.
Can you explain what you mean by ahistorical Trump supporters?
Well, they have no – one of the things that I think has happened in America is that most people have not had a chance to understand the actual history of the United States in the 20th century. It's true of other times as well. Most of what most of us learn in school is a kind of glossing over of American history, which suggests that it all was good and it all came out good in the end, and everything that happened was for the best in the end. Ignoring the genocide of the Native Americans, ignoring the aggression against Mexico that created the United States, ignoring a whole host of issues, because it's all good.
So when Trump says, make America great again,
yeah,
and when his supporters respond to that, what they're really saying is, let's go back to a time when America was great for white people, but not so great for everybody else.
Yeah, and I don't...
And also... back to a time when they could insult women and minorities with impunity.
Right.
That's what they mean by political correctness these days. When someone's when someone complains about political correctness, that means I can't say what I want about women and minorities whenever I feel like it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And a sense of constraint on one's freedom of expression, however stupid your expression might be. There's a whole host of issues historically. People really don't understand that during the period of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Social Security was created, basically old age insurance, a whole beginning of a pattern of concern for ordinary people's lives. And when I say ordinary, I mean from the very poorest to the relatively wealthy. Moreover, after the war, when I say the war, I'm this old. When I say the war, I mean World War II. What's sometimes called the last good war. And what happened after that, into the 70s, from the beginning of that time, was the GI Bill. It gave people a chance to have an education, predominantly men. And by the way it was structured, predominantly white men, excluding persons of color, largely, in the South particularly. Remember that the Democratic Party under FDR was essentially a party that made a deal with the Dixiecrats in the South, the segregationists, with organized labor in the North and the Middle States and so on, and with the old party machines in the East Coast and Chicago and places like that. That deal fell apart around the Vietnam War. And it fell apart brutally. Not many of our audience probably remembered that workers, I think building the original World Trade Center, came off of the building to attack the peace marchers in downtown in the Lower East Side of New York. Brutally attacked them.
I would say that the deal fell apart around civil rights as well.
Well, yeah, oh, yeah, of course. In fact, Johnson understood that. I mean,
he did.
He understood that what he was doing, which he believed honestly was right, which was to give the rights that every American should have to African Americans, would result in the loss of the solid South to the Democratic Party.
Right.
And it did. And it's now a Republican Party.
Right. So how long do conservative Southerners hold a grudge? A really long time, it appears. The reason we still had Dixiecrats, the reason we still had the solid Democratic South up till that point, was that there was no way that white Southerners were going to be Republicans, because Republicans were the party of Lincoln. They were the people who freed the slaves, even though political polarity had reversed itself entirely between the time of Reconstruction and the time of civil rights. They were still holding on and were solid Democrats, because they're stubborn old bigots. But when civil rights legislation was passed, that's when we saw the wholesale migration begin of conservative Southern white Democrats to the Republican Party.
Right. Well, I don't know about that. I don't know about the motive of bigotry itself. It does exist, but I don't know whether that was the only factor.
Oh, it's a big factor, and I hope to get into that a little bit later.
Oh, okay. That's fine. We will. And I think it's really important to understand that all of the political alignments that existed coming into the 70s were shattered by the Vietnam War, by the real argument between people who believed that we could use military force to control the world and those who thought that that was a very foolhardy approach. And that is today playing out. We now have, amazingly, a seemingly liberal African-American president actually advocating the creation of more, in this case, small tactical nuclear weapons. Weapons that, in other words, could be more easily deployed and more rationally, I put quotes on that, used. We are in actually a very bad situation. Meanwhile, a person like Donald Trump, who has been given kind of a pass by the media because he's good copy, is able to assume the titular headship of the Republican Party and promises to spend a lot of time and a lot of money attacking Hillary Clinton for allegedly bad behavior of her husband, and to make the contest a very personal and unpleasant one rather than one about issues and ideas. Because, in fact, Donald Trump, if you examine what he says, really doesn't have any ideas.
Oh, it's got the wall.
Got the wall is silly.
And he wants to keep Muslims out.
Yeah, that's silly.
Yeah. He wants to cut taxes for rich people.
That is, of course, always, in modern terms, a popular idea of the Republican Party.
He wants to make America great again.
Yeah, and that is based on the idea of how it was during the great growth period following World War II, in which you saw the ability of people, primarily white GIs, to buy homes, to have good jobs, to live lives that were excellent. I mean, the automotive industry was booming, the steel industry was booming, a lot of stuff was going on. Meanwhile, as the world internationalized in terms of capitalism, that was slowly going away.
So Trump, when he says make America great again, he wants to rewind to the 40s and 50s.
Well, if to the degree that he thinks.
Well, no, I'm talking about the 1840s and 50s. That's where Trump wants to go back to.
Well, I think actually I can't speak for Trump, but his model really is post-war America. The late 40s, then the 1950s, and the 1960s, up to the Vietnam War.
Right. But a few moments ago, you said you were unsure to the extent of which bigotry was a factor in all this, in reaching as far back as the transition of the Dixiecrats away from the Democrats to the Republicans. I think it's a huge factor, and it's a huge factor behind Donald Trump's success. A statistic I saw yesterday when doing some reading for this show, 64% of Trump supporters believe that President Obama is a Muslim.
Yeah, I keep forgetting that because it's so weird.
Yeah, and that's
and you're right. You're right.
And that's become a sort of litmus test these days as to whether or not you are an unreconstructed bigot. If you believe the president, in the face of all evidence, is actually a secret Muslim, chances are you're a bit of a racist.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with that.
Okay, but moreover, the part that racism has played in conservatism for a long time really can't be overstated. Lee Atwater, do you remember him?
I do.
A conservative political operative dating back to for decades now.
Yeah.
I think he's dead now, isn't he?
I don't know. I can't tell when these guys are dead or alive.
Anyway, Lee Atwater was the author of President Nixon's famous Southern Strategy. And for those of you who are unaware of what the Southern Strategy is, it's something that transcended Nixon. It's something that played a part in all national Republican campaigns from that moment, really to the present, even though we had a Republican National Committee chairman officially apologize for the Southern Strategy. Mm-hmm. I think it's very much still a part of modern conservative politics. Here's what Atwater said in a famous interview back in the 80s. He's describing how you appeal to the racists, conservatives in the South. Here's what he says. You start out in 1954 by saying N-word, N-word, N-word. By 1968, you can't say N-word. That hurts you. It backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And now you're getting so abstract. Now you're talking about cutting taxes. And all these things you're talking about are totally economic things, but a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. This is an overt and conscious part of conservative political strategy. Even when they're talking about cutting taxes on the wealthy in the name of trickle-down economics, they are, with a wink and a nod to their racist base, saying, this is going to screw the black and brown people.
Yeah, and another aspect of this is, of course, the fact that incomes in the United States for ordinary people, for people who work hard, who have even middle-class jobs, the incomes are shrinking, and we're even seeing that the white, typical white middle-class persons and working-class persons, particularly men, are dying earlier, which is a certain sign that things are going awry.
Yeah, indeed. So I hear elites in the Republican Party and in the media establishment wringing their hands right now, clutching their pearls, and bemoaning the fact that Trump has somehow hijacked the conservative movement. No, he has hijacked nothing. This is the conservative movement reaping the bitter harvest that it has sown for the past several decades. For several decades, conservatism has said to the American people, particularly to white conservatives, support us, cut our taxes, and we'll make sure that somehow you end up in a better position than the black and the brown people. This is the devil's bargain that Republican elites made with their white working class base.
And it's a kind of magical thinking which requires an ahistorical analysis.
An ahistorical analysis, right. All right, references back to this golden age that never really existed for anyone but straight white guys.
Yeah.
Right. So now that they've been saying this, conservatives, for several decades, cut our taxes, something will trickle down to you, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Nixon's Law and Order campaign, welfare moms, forced busing, the whole subliminal Atwater construction that we just talked about. And now we arrive at Donald Trump at a time when there's a black man in the White House. All of a sudden people
Muslim.
Are surprised.
He's a Muslim.
All of a sudden, he wasn't
born in this country.
Right. All of a sudden people are surprised
right.
that the racist base has risen up and taken over the Republican Party. Well, that's been the Republican Party all this time.
Well, and it's also important to remember that Democrats, to a large extent, did this to themselves. President Clinton, in fact...
Well, the Democrats did what to themselves?
Well, they created a large population of prisoners, for example. They created a prison industrial complex, which has eaten up some of the most creative and some of the most progressive minds in the African-American community, in the Hispanic community, and in the white working class community.
And you think that has a bearing on what the Republicans have done to themselves?
I think it has a bearing on the disenfranchisement of people who had an insightful understanding of American history. And I think that this is a significant moment where that comes home to roost in a very ugly way.
Yeah, in a very ugly way.
You know.
Should we see what our callers have to say?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, let's go to the phones. Sean, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Yeah.
Quick point of correction. It's possible that I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that the Southern Strategy was authored by the great author Kevin Phillips. He started off as a Republican strategist and, of course, went on to become a brilliant writer, taking the side of the workers and the poor.
Well, that could be.
Yeah, true. He was part of constructing the Southern Strategy as well. Yes, absolutely okay. Right. Probably even more so than Atwater. You're right.
Absolutely. And I think Atwater died very young, surprisingly, but... Anyway, thank you, KBOO. You guys have aired interviews with Thomas Frank, the famous author of What's the Matter with Kansas? He has a new book out called Listen, Liberal. I guess it's a take on the old book Listen, Yankee, about imperialism. But his new book...
I think it was Listen, White Man. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, his new book talks about, we can point all the fingers at, the Republicans for the rise of Donald Trump. But in fact, if we want our economy run by people like Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner, where we basically throw poor people and workers under the bus in the favor of the yuppies and the so-called young creatives and, the coalition of the ascendant or whatever you want to call it, we really have no one else to blame but Carter, Clinton, Hillary. So all of these pragmatists, all of you out there who are casting a vote today for Hillary, guess who's responsible for the rise of Donald Trump? All of you pragmatists who just fine to throw poor people and workers under the bus.
I sort of agree with you, but I think it's really important to understand, in terms of this popular contest, the role of the media, which is absolutely the ultimate form of a whore, really.
Well,
it will go where they will go wherever the money is, and Trump is great copy for, what was it, 14 years? I can't even remember the number of years. He ran a stupid show, which was very popular, two stupid shows, basically pretending that he could train people to be executives based on nothing except his charisma and the fact that the nation's NBC actually was willing to put a lot of money into him. That created an unusual opportunity. Then, right, as a star, he reaps the advantages of that, and the media, looking at this thing, is unwilling to make the ultimate evaluation that is so important. Not even on the editorial pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Oregonian.
Well, this is how Thomas Frank put it. Thomas Frank described the last 40 years as consisting of workers' lives and the lives of the poor becoming ever more wretched and precarious, while the lives of the wealthy have become ever increasingly delicious. Yeah. Okay, and I think that's a pretty accurate summary of what's
going
on.
Very nicely put.
And if we go back to, say, take 1992, you had a New Deal Democrat like Tom Harkin out of Iowa. Certainly, you know, not a democratic socialist, not someone I would support wholeheartedly, but at least a New Deal Democrat. And you had people jumping on board with Bill Clinton, a right-wing Democrat from Arkansas. You know, there's no one else to blame but the Democratic Party and the so-called pragmatists who have thrown poor people and workers under the bus and not supported labor unions, not supported egalitarian economics, who appoint people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner into positions of power. No one to blame but themselves and the Democratic Party and getting on board the Goldman Sachs Wall Street train.
I agree with you, but there's another. We're going to let you go. I thank you for those comments. I want to make clear something that was in the New York Times today. People may not have seen it, which is that the blue collar working unions, the construction workers and so on, feel very betrayed by the Democratic Party. They wanted the XL pipeline. They wanted lots of certain kinds of jobs to be created. Meanwhile, the future really does lie with the moneyed class from technology that definitely see the destruction of the world consequent to our incredibly and incalculably bad behavior toward the environment. This is an enormous split and a very serious one that I don't see how the Democratic Party can put this back together. At its risk, it can put it together. We are in an enormous environmental crisis. I mean, all you have to do is look at the popular news and see the tornadoes, see the incredible weird weather behavior all over the world, understand what the huge construction in Bangladesh or wherever else, everywhere really, Louisiana, and its consequence for the weather and for flooding and for survival of human beings. All of this is taking place kind of not as a background, but as the foreground of people's lives. Meanwhile, denial is the ruling force, and it ties up everything. There's another thing going on, which is that the Republicans decided as a party, I believe, to absolutely not cooperate on anything with the Democrats, and particularly with Barack Obama. And I think the root of that really is racism more than anything else.
I would agree. Yeah. Let's tell people how they get a hold of us. 503-231-8187 is the number to call to take part in this conversation. If you don't want to call, you can leave a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe. Also, we're on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Speaking of the Twitter machine, David writes in to say, I hate saying it, but increasingly I feel it's true. If Trump is the 45th U.S. president, there probably won't be a 46th.
Well, who knows? You know, he'll probably be, I think what they're negotiating now is how to control him. But here's the thing.
Please, I have something to follow up with, but go ahead, please.
Well, really quickly, if you pay attention to the history of what happened in Germany, I'm not trying to say this is a parallel, because the way in which Germany was treated after World War I left Germany in a terrible economic turmoil. And there were very powerful right and left parties. And there was a feeling among the ruling class conservatives that Hitler would work because they could control him. But the fact of the matter is that the parallel here is Trump, not with a Hitlerian philosophy in every aspect, but Trump is thought of even now by the Republican Party as somebody they can control. But he has many of the charismatic qualities, many of the absurd arguments, and many of the racist bases and sexist bases that you see in the Nazi movement. And I really think this is a very scary moment in American history. And I'm not at all sure. I don't think Bernie has a chance of the nomination. And I think he really is going to have to work very hard if he's going to get his base to cooperate with Hillary. And I don't know that that's going to be doable. And maybe a lot of people will stay home rather than voting. The danger, the enormous, overwhelming danger of a Trump presidency cannot be overestimated.
You're right. You just mentioned what the Republican establishment right now is trying to figure out how they're going to control Trump. Here's how they're going to control Trump. Part of Trump's appeal up to this point was the inaccurate claim that he was entirely self-funded and he was answerable to no one and therefore could not be bought. But right now, as the presumptive nominee, he is scrambling to put together a fundraising apparatus to raise the estimated $1 billion that it will likely take to win the White House. So right now, Trump is busy preparing to climb into the pockets of the very people he's claimed to be independent from all this time. And I guarantee you, as soon as he starts taking people's money, he will begin to be answerable to them. And thus, the Republican establishment will make him one of their own.
And it is a really important mistake not to make, to think that the Republican establishment is not, to think it's not racist, to think it's relatively liberal in the larger sense of that term. It's not so. It really is not just conservative, but, and this is the key word that we don't hear enough in American politics, reactionary.
It's true. Let's go to the phones. BJ, good morning.
Hey, good morning. So I was watching Morning Joe 2 days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, and they pretty much just showed a preview of what the general election is going to look like if Hillary gets the nomination. It's all going to be about Jeffrey Epstein and Bill Clinton's friendship. And Jeffrey Epstein is convicted of child prostitution and sex crimes. And Bill Clinton had a lot of time on his private jet going to and from his private island. And Trump is not scared to use that. And it's going to be a really sleazy campaign. And the issues are not going to get talked about. And well, I don't think with that Clinton is going to be able to pivot a strong argument of, the war on women and an anti-patriarchal argument against Trump when he comes back with, well, she enabled, Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton is the epitome of, rape culture. And, especially with all the sleazy things he's going to say. And when you were talking about a lot of the pushback on Obama, I don't think Clinton is going to be a good, she's going to be able to carry the flag of anti-racism either when the birther movement started with her campaign. Now, it wasn't from her directly, but she didn't disavow it either.
I don't know about that.
I don't know that you can hang the birther movement on Hillary Clinton.
It started with her supporters. They were called PUMAs, Party Unity My A. And
you're talking back about 19, like you're talking about
2008. 2008. And, her campaign, the official campaign, released a picture of Obama when he was visiting Kenya. Had a traditional Kenyan outfit on, questioning his, quote unquote, American values. She never.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether she disavowed that or not. I do know that she has been a faithful supporter of Clinton since the time that she was incorporated into the establishment under him. So,
Well, he kind of had to do that. He had to keep Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Look into history. The Clinton wing basically threatened Obama with, withholding any of their support. If they didn't get Secretary of State, if Debbie Wasserman Schultz didn't get to be the DNC chair, they kind of held him hostage.
I don't want to argue right now as to where the birther movement originated, but I don't think we're going to see that hung around Hillary Clinton's neck in this campaign. I think what she's got to worry about and what the rest of us are going to have to endure is a whole bunch of misogynist humiliation tossed her way by the Republican nominee.
Yeah, and I think that...
And thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, first of all, I don't know anything about and don't know that there's any relevance to Bill Clinton's alleged behavior toward women back 20, 30 years ago. I don't see that would necessarily have to be relevant, but it's clear that Trump intends to make that relevant. His thrust, his direct attacks will be on him and through attacks on Bill Clinton, on Hillary. She's going to be cast as an enabler. She's going to be cast as a vicious attacker of women who have claimed having been mistreated by Bill Clinton. A lot of nasty stuff. What there is not going to be is any kind of reasoned discussion about economic policy, international relations, or any of the other aspects of life that are really important to the future of the United States, the environment, or any of that stuff. And what's really, really scary about this is that the best you can hope with a Trump presidency is that he will yield his decision-making to the old established Republican Party. And that's the best you can hope.
All right, who's next, Steve? Jimmy, good morning.
Yeah, morning. Hey, guys. I just got out of prison a couple weeks ago, and I used to listen to you guys when I was in prison, and you guys really are really refreshing compared to most of the media out there.
You know, thank you.
And, yeah, you're welcome. I was just going to say, Donald Trump's like a Trojan horse, and when that horse gets inside the fort, the door, little thing's going to open, and the Waltons are going to jump out, and the Koch brothers, and with, you know, running around, go, ah. So, like, I mean, you know, look at the Waltons. They're worth $145 billion. What is there, three or four of them? You know, and that's money that they stole from the middle class. That should have gone to people with decent jobs, benefits, you know,
yeah,
with
you're right about that.
the gold watch retirement myth, jobs that don't exist anymore. But like Joe said, if you study early 20th century history back in during the Depression and even farther back with Theodore Roosevelt, you know, and when there was muckrakers like Ida Tarbell who went up against these giant trusts and these people who, you know, how much does one man need? How much wealth does one man need? I mean, it's kind of a, you know, I'm not saying you should take one man's money and give it away to another man, but, you know, I was reading a story or listening to a story on the radio, and they said that, you know, somebody paid $100 million for an apartment in Manhattan that overlooks Central Park. It's like, you know, why would someone need to do that? It makes you question the whole, you know, Keynesian economics theories and, you know. So I look at the bigger picture and stuff, and I like how Joe has a lot of historical context when you guys talk about, you know, the overall picture.
Well, I think you're right.
Thanks
I think,
very much.
I think. Thank you for the call. I think that I also think it's really important to understand that there are other kinds of connections here that are very significant. The present, I really want to be careful on this because it's important to understand the connection between a very reactionary government currently in Israel that intends not to allow a Palestinian state to have any any survival capability, and Sheldon Adelson. Mm-hmm. Who is essentially a gambler with great success in Macau and other locations, is ready to dump $100 million or more into Trump's campaign. Now, Trump, let's remember this, has a lot of connections to dubious characters and certainly has made a huge amount of money to the detriment of cities like Atlantic City in the gambling industry. I mean, that's what he is.
Listen, hey, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Aaron writes into the Facebook page to say, Obama won 80% of the minority votes in both elections. The GOP has to do something to appeal to non-white voters if it wants to stick around, period. So when white supremacists think you're the candidate they've been waiting for, you're doing something wrong. Trump is winning in the Republican race, but the Republican Party is mostly white, a voting demographic that is shrinking nationally. I have more faith in the American people, especially after two terms of a black man named Hussein. I think that is a very good point.
Well, it is a good point, and I hope that person... I forgot the name.
Aaron
is right.
Yeah.
But I'm really quite frightened by all of this. I'm frightened by the fact that, for example, Obama, not because he's pressured by Congress, not because he's blocked by Congress, but because apparently he's bought into these ideas about, for example, small nuclear weapons. It seems like, oh, a tiny thing. Well, no, it's not. It could very well be, from what we know about the science of nuclear weaponry, it could very well be the hastening of the destruction of the environment.
Especially in the hands of Donald Trump.
Well, yeah. And again, I made this reference to Hitler. The assumption is that Trump will be controllable, and it may well be the case. On the other hand, when we're talking about controllable, what we're really talking about is controllable in the context of an enormous right-wing thrust toward the governing of the world, not just the United States.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, journalist Rami Khoury speaks on Arab jails and American jets. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features excerpts from the documentary film Citizen 4. At 11, on stage and studio, host Dimay Roberts features the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event that celebrates the history of the Oregon community washed away during the 1948 flood. The story of Vanport is a fascinating one, and if you're a Portlander and you don't know it, do a little reading.
Yeah, you really should pay attention to that.
And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Andre Middleton interviews fine paper-cutting artist Christina Hart. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Okay.
Let's go back to the phones.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, 231-8187, and we're talking about the Donald.
Stan, good morning.
Hey, guys. I wanted to talk about a few things, but I got to get into appointment. But you guys mentioned misogyny, and I just think it's interesting. I think Joe used the word whore to describe the media, and that I consider a pretty misogynistic term. Oh. So you might want to think about it.
Well, I want to think about that, but I also know that, you got a good point. I'm not going to argue with you on that.
I mean, what's the word whore used for often? It's used to describe a woman, right?
Yeah,
well,
you're
more
exactly
often
right.
than a man.
Yeah, point
so
taken.
You have a good point.
Yep. You are correct.
Okay, thanks, Scott. I have a 5-month-old daughter, so I'm starting to learn a lot of stuff.
Hey, well, congratulations on that.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye. Brian writes into the Facebook page to say, you just, unwittingly or not, hit the Drumpf infestation square on the block, rung the bell, and are entitled to a coconut prize of choice. The corporate owner media, especially electronic and flickering screen versions and its control over people's lives and consciousness, has reduced the voting population to a somnambulist race snoring its way through its own history. That's very nicely put. This and a deliberately selective nationalist education system uninterested in issues attracts personalities like flies to a word I can't say on the air. Can you think of another reasonably educated nation in which this narcissistic twit would even be taken seriously or allowed to run? And the answer to that, I think, is no. I can't.
No, I don't agree with that. I think we're seeing it all over Europe. I think when we look at the Pan phenomenon in France, it's very similar. It's a phenomenon of angry people who feel disconnected from power and from justice. And I think we're seeing that also in parts of Germany, and we're seeing it in many, many other places. I think there is, in the West, a tendency toward an enormous push toward a very reactionary, simplistic approach to the way the world is managed.
Yeah, but is Le Pen going to get anywhere near the French presidency?
Yes.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Francis, good morning.
Hi, you guys have said a lot. I'm going to say again, the revolution will not be televised. While the media is covering this joke and playing down Bernie Sanders' campaign to the extreme to promote Hillary and Donald as the contestants in this horse race is... I don't think it's just because Trump brings in money for them. I think it's a concerted effort to try to quash the people's movement. And I think that these warmongers, you can take your pick, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, are not the people's choice. Now, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, we talk about the racist thing in Congress. The obstructionism that's going on right now is so racist. I've heard I don't remember his name, one of the congressmen down there, referring to the animal in the White House, referring to President Obama as the animal. And
well, that's a real racist trope.
Bill Clinton, when he was campaigning for Hillary, when he went to Ted Kennedy to try to get some money, he spoke of President Obama by saying to Ted Kennedy, well, you know, this guy, a few years ago, he would have been carrying our luggage.
Is that true? No, wait a minute. Francis, is that actually factual?
Yes, it's true. And apparently Ted Kennedy was very outraged by the statement, and that's how it became, people knew about it, because of Kennedy's reaction to the statement. And also, you know, Hillary's little comments about the super predators, and that we need to bring them to heel. You know, I don't trust Hillary Clinton, and I never will. Now, the media can say, and everyone is saying, if Trump gets elected, it's the end of us, it's the dooming. That's what we thought when Reagan was elected. Another one of those theater people, you know. But if we're going to change things, I see in social media, there's a lot of talk about either starting a third party or doing a write-in campaign for Bernie Sanders. I think people are just waiting to see if he's willing to do it. Because myself and a lot of people I know, there's no way in the world that I will vote for Hillary Clinton to keep Trump from being president, because neither one of them is worthy of being there.
That's very interesting.
And this is a movement, and people need to realize it isn't about those players in that horse race. It's about the people's movement. And it's not going to be stopped, whether Hillary or the Trump get elected.
Okay, well,
thank you, Francis.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
You know, I think she's right. The movement that's behind Bernie Sanders, I think, will outlive his candidacy, particularly when you consider two things. One, the very robust support he enjoys amongst younger voters. And two, the fact that those younger voters, young people today, are overwhelmingly progressive on nearly every issue across the board. So I don't think we're going to see this little flame lit by Bernie Sanders go out anytime soon. The question, and you alluded to this earlier, is how many concessions is he going to be able, presuming that Hillary Clinton becomes the Democratic nominee, how many concessions will he be able to exact from her to get the Democratic Party to hew closer to a platform that supports workers and ordinary people and the environment?
Well, it is a very difficult dance that has to be carried out. Assuming, and I think it's a reasonable assumption, that Hillary has the nomination. I mean, things can change suddenly, but it looks like that's the case. And in fact, I always have believed that the voting, the national voting process, is only one tool in the toolbox for social change. But it becomes very, very scary when you consider that Trump violates all of the norms in the direction of fascism. In fact, actually, to the degree that he thinks at all, other than thinking about himself, he is a proto-fascist. And that's real. Now, Hillary, a lot of people don't like her. A lot of people see her politics as lacking any kind of left credential. A lot of people are extremely disappointed in the Democratic Party generally. The great looming crisis that overwhelms all of this is, what are we going to do about an increasingly clear crisis in the environment? And that is not being addressed. Certainly it's not going to be addressed by Trump. And I don't think it's adequately being addressed by the Democratic mainstream either.
No. And it should be noted, as the Sanders campaign has observed many times, that the fossil fuel industry is a significant donor to Secretary Clinton's campaign.
Well, the fossil fuel industry is a significant donor to anybody who will continue to support the fossil fuel industry.
They have no ideology
beyond profit.
All right. Aaron writes into the Facebook page to ask, do you guys think there's any chance for a libertarian like Jesse Ventura? I think the answer is no.
No.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Nan, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I tuned in a little bit late, but boy, have you helped me wake my brain up.
Good.
Oh, my gosh. I wanted to very quickly hit on a couple of things Joe said that I completely agree with, and then a quick comment about Francis as well. When you said, Joe, that what they're probably negotiating now with Trump is how to control him, I absolutely, completely agree with you. I think it's actually pretty obvious that that's what's happening. And especially when you compared him to Nazi Germany, who thought they could control, in quotes, Hitler. I see the very same scenario. And when you said that, I had a sort of a flashback, if you will, to one of the times that Bush was campaigning for office. I think it was the second time. And there were only one or two images that I've never been able to erase from my brain of crowds that he incited to levels of violence I had never seen. I'm 61, and I hadn't seen this before in American politics. And I thought they were fascist, period. I mean, just absolutely fascist. You know, they would only let, remember, you had to be on a list, or you had to be the right kind of person to even get into their rallies, how they were just crazy about it. Now we take this sort of behavior, thanks to Trump, for granted, but it was pretty new then and very scary. I completely agree that he is a proto-fascist. That word is the absolute right one to use. And the comment about Francis's comments is that I, if necessary, will hold my nose and vote for Hillary Clinton, because the idea of Donald Trump actually getting to office, which more and more seems very, I almost feel like there's a cabal, like there is something conspiratorial about this. I had the same feelings about Bush, that there's a good darn chance he will get into office, and it frightens me to no end. So by not voting for her, I mean, it's like cutting off our nose to spite our face. Do we really want this person, this corporate handmaid, this evil man, as I see him, a proto-fascist, I absolutely agree, running our country completely into the ground? I mean, we're at least halfway there already.
You know,
those people frighten me who say things like that.
I usually encourage caution when you start talking about conspiratorial formulations, but I think it bears observing that in 2000, all the conservatives had to do was get the race close enough to steal it at the very end.
That's right. That's right. And we had a resident in thief instead of in chief as a result.
Hey, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for both of you. I absolutely adore what you do.
Thank you so much. All right. Pamela writes into the Facebook page to say, Trump may be controllable, but I doubt his followers will be. The ugliness of this is what repulses me and has me casting about, wondering about finding sanctuary in a less racist, more peace-loving culture. Repulsion is an appropriate word to use in this case. The campaign of this man and the sentiments of his followers are repulsive. They have no place in a civilized discourse. Well, but yet, there they are.
Yeah, I agree. But of course, American national politics forever has been vicious and ugly and irrelevant to the actual issues. I mean, this is not something new. We saw it in the 1840s. We saw it in the 1830s. It's part of our nationalist heritage, good or bad. I think bad. And I want to just throw something out here because it's a light against this darkness. Father Berrigan, the last of the two Berrigan brothers, died. His continuous witnessing for peace, largely dismissed by most of us, is a very important thing. It's a very important model. My own growth, and it's been through various leftist positions, has always been influenced by Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement. Now, I'm not a Catholic, and I'm not a believer in a divine intervention at all. But I do think it's really important to understand the enormous ethical struggle that various groups within various religious and non-religious traditions to build a just society and to build a peaceful world. And that is something we all have to use, I believe, as an anchor in the face of all this craziness.
Yeah, I agree. Let's go back to the phones. Dave, good morning.
Yes, I think some of this comes from when Ralph Nader was running. It was bandied around that even if things get really bad, you know, and that means like Trump or Bush, then people will come out and vote for progressives. And I don't think they understand the political system doesn't quite work that way. We could get Trump in, and he could be really bad, and then they can rebrand themselves the Republican Party and say, hey, we've got somebody now that's really good, or whatever. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do understand what you mean. I think there's an enormous power within what I would call, I hate the word cabal, but what I would call a unity among the ruling class. And we see that in the control of the national news networks.
Yeah.
And the folding of the independent press in America, which is happening a lot. We also see that in the tendency within both the Democratic and Republican parties to move toward a floating center, which becomes increasingly right wing.
I just want to say one more thing. So people that are Democrats or progressive, whatever, and they're presented with Trump or Hillary, and they don't vote for Hillary, they're voting for Trump, whether they know it or not, and they're also voting against the environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, I was just handed a note. Ralph Nader, who I have argued with, actually on the telephone, will be the guest on Wednesday's talk radio show, same time as our show, 8 to 9. Yeah, now, I understand that just like the role he played in 2000, he sees himself as a critical spoiler, hoping for a progressive outcome. My personal view is that his analysis is very flawed, but certainly people should pay attention to his argument and listen to him very carefully.
I agree. All right, back to the phones. Who do we have, Steve? Anita, good morning.
Good morning. May I point out that this is still the primary? The Hillary is the Democratic nominee is not yet determined.
You are correct.
Bernie Sanders has not yet been mathematically eliminated, and he's in there until the absolute end and convention fight, I hope. But may I point out also that in the primary, you can actually do a protest vote if you've already given up. But otherwise, I'm thinking that since I live in Vancouver and we went 78.4% for Bernie, as opposed to King County, you know, Seattle, 67.5% for Bernie, mm-hmm. as opposed to the whole state at 73% for Bernie, if Portland can't come up with at least 78.4% for Bernie, I think we in Vancouver ought to be able to call you all down there Lower Vancouver.
Hey, we will never let that happen.
Yeah, so y'all better get out and vote for Bernie. Anyway,
here, here.
Thank you all for the program.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
She makes a very good point. The nominating process is not over yet, despite the way the math looks at the moment. And also, this is perhaps a good time to mention that there appear to be a whole lot of shenanigans in the Democratic nominating process.
No.
Witness what happened in Nevada, where Bernie won the state primary, yet was not allocated a majority of delegates.
That's true. I have to remind people that both Abe and I are hobbled by the rules of a nonprofit.
Engineer Steve just reminds us that so far only 25% of voters have turned in their ballots in Oregon. So if you're still sitting on yours, today's the day.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. I want to emphasize that the process of voting, the process of the legitimate system, is only one tool in a greater struggle to create a more just and more sound world.
Yeah. Let's go back to the telephones. Scott, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the chance to talk.
You bet. Gotta make it fast, though.
Pardon me?
Gotta make it fast.
Okay. I think the lesson of Ralph Nader, where he probably blundered by not putting his support behind Al Gore, and then we got George W. Bush for president. If that isn't just a flamingly obvious case of practicality in politics, okay, Hillary may not be perfect, but do you want an unpredictable joker of a wild card in the White House at a time when things are so delicate and so unbalanced as they are? Golly, I mean, I think that lesson of putting George W. Bush in there because people were too intransigent to see the practicality of supporting normalcy. I mean, people say, oh, well, things are so terrible they can't get worse. Oh, yes, they sure can get worse.
Oh, yes, they sure can.
Hey, we've run out of time. I really appreciate that last call. I really think people should study what happened in 2000 because this is real. This is not a fantasy. It's not fantasy football. It's real. And this is really happening. And it, you know, closing your eyes and shutting your mouth and blocking your ears will not make it go away.
Might make you feel better.
No, I'm kidding.
Turn in your ballots, everybody, and we'll be back at you next week.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All-African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All-African People's Revolutionary Party speaking about organizing for Pan-Africanism in Gambia and throughout Africa. Again, that's a message from the Women of Gambia, a part of the Pan-African Film Festival, Wednesday, May 18th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Room 333 at PSU, 1826 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at